Knowledge Products presents Karl Marx, Das Kapital, Part 2.
At this point, the president places a dagger in the new member's hand.
May I be punished with a traitor's death. May I be slain with this blade if I break this oath. I consent to be treated as a traitor if I reveal the least thing to anyone, even my closest relative, if he is not a member of this association.
Citizen, be seated. The society receives your oath. Citizen, your name will no longer be spoken among us. Here is your membership number. You should provide yourself with arms and ammunition. The committee which leads the society will remain unknown up to the moment when we take up arms. Citizen, one of your duties is to spread the association's principles. If you know citizens who are devout and discreet, you must present them to us.
Most of the revolutionaries were concentrated in Paris. There was also a very large population of Germans in Paris. It was said that you could hear German spoken on every street. The Germans were migratory workers, mainly skilled craftsmen, and also middle-class intellectuals, some refugees from political persecution at home, and some just passing through to find out the latest developments in the vanguard of progress. Some of these Germans joined the French secret societies, and some formed their own German-speaking societies. They fed revolutionary ideas back into Germany. In 1842, the German writer Lorenz von Stein published his book, The Socialism and Communism of Present-Day France. And it was immediately read by middle-class intellectuals throughout the German-speaking world. Stein was not a communist or a socialist, but he made socialism and communism widely known. He presented communism as the product of modern economic development and identified it with the new working class, the proletariat. One of the German workers who became a communist in Paris was named Wilhelm Weitling. He was the illegitimate child of a German servant girl and one of Napoleon's troops. He had only elementary education, but taught himself through his wide reading. He became a traveling tailor and arrived in Paris in 1837. He soon joined one of the German-speaking secret societies, known as the League of the Just. Weitling quickly became the leading figure in the League, and his writings were soon widely read, though confiscated by the police whenever possible. Weitling's proposed communism was a system where money had been abolished, leading to the elimination of greed and envy. Everyone would have the opportunity for university education, and training in science would be universal. Choice of occupation would be voluntary, and work would be paid in vouchers representing hours of labor. Outstanding innovators would be selected by experts and given positions of honor and authority. Weitling expected production to increase by 300% in the first 5 years of communism. After being involved in street fighting in Paris, the League of the Just was broken up by the police, and its members were imprisoned or driven abroad. The League moved its headquarters to London, and Weitling moved to Switzerland, which was then a center of revolutionary agitation. In Switzerland, he was arrested and imprisoned for writings considered blasphemous, and then exiled from Switzerland. Because of his writings and his personal courage against state persecution, Weitling was now recognized as the leader of communism. He moved to London, and here made the acquaintance of Marx, who had recently been converted to communism. A small group of communists, led by Weitling, Marx, Engels, and Moses Hess, met and corresponded frequently to hammer out their ideas. At first, Marx was greatly impressed by Weitling, but soon grew tired of his religiosity and reliance on ethical appeals. Weitling presented communism as true Christianity and based his arguments on the Bible. He always made explicit his passionate ethical judgments. Marx, on the other hand, was an atheist, and although just as passionate a moralist as Weitling, Marx was sickened by any sanctimonious language or appeals to abstract principles of justice. Partly in reaction to Weitling, Marx was beginning to develop his view that communism should be thoroughly scientific. In Marx's view, it was important to show that communism was the outcome of present-day trends, that is, the trends of the 1840s, especially the rapid growth of industry and the new working class. Capitalism, the new system of social organization, which was spreading across Europe along with factories and railroads, was unstable. It was constantly being torn apart by its own inherent conflicts, which could only be finally resolved by a worldwide communist revolution. With these ideas fixed in his mind, Marx commenced his very thorough study of economics. Both Weitling and Marx were arrogant individuals who found it difficult to tolerate disagreement. Weitling emigrated to the United States, leaving Marx as the leading personality in the League of the Just, which changed its name to the Communist League, and in 1848 issued the famous Communist Manifesto. In that year, almost the whole of continental Europe was racked by terrible revolutionary uprisings. None of these uprisings was communist-inspired. They were concerned with issues of self-government, extension of the right to vote, and freedom of speech and of the press. But the insurrection seemed to show that European society was increasingly unstable. This conclusion was reinforced by growing awareness of a disturbing new feature of capitalism, the business cycle, or trade cycle, which suddenly and mysteriously created slump and hard times after every period of increasing prosperity. The business cycle was interpreted by many socialists and communists to mean that the new system, capitalism, could not digest the abundance generated by science and machinery. Therefore, capitalism periodically had to destroy the wealth that had been created. The trade cycle also showed to many socialists that capitalism was out of control and urgently required some kind of central direction. The foundation of Marx's economic system is his theory of value. His entire theory of the exploitation of labor is based on the labor theory of value, which he developed out of the theory of value held by the classical economists. The term classical economists was coined by Marx, although he used it to mean only those economists who advocated a labor theory of value. Marx's name for other economists who advocated a utility theory of value or a supply and demand theory of value was vulgar economists. The goal of a theory of value is to explain prices, including those prices we call wages, profits, interest, and rent. A labor theory of value explains prices in terms of labor. In its simplest form, a labor theory of value would say that goods always sell in direct proportion to the labor required to produce them. On this theory, if a carriage wheel sells for 6 times the price of a kettle, then this would prove that making the carriage wheel had required exactly 6 times as many man-hours as making the kettle. Before we go any further, we must be clear that no one, and certainly not Marx, has ever held this simple form of the labor theory of value. To the classical economists, a form of the labor theory of value seemed plausible because manufactured goods tend to sell at a price which equals their costs of production plus a markup which corresponds to interest, or the regular rate of profit. But if we analyze these costs of production, most of them, or even all of them, seem to be traceable back to labor. Wages are obviously a payment for labor, while the money paid for raw materials and fuel may be seen as payment for the labor of producing or extracting them. And buildings and machines also have to be paid for, which ultimately means payment for the labor required to construct them. It is certainly true that the prices of manufactured goods do tend toward cost of production plus a standard markup. To the classical economists, this seemed the one sure fact on which they could rely. A difficulty with this theory is that it does not explain the level of profit or interest, the level of the standard markup. This led some socialist writers before Marx to argue that profit or interest was derived from underpaying the workers. We should notice, however, that the labor theory of value does not automatically imply that rewards should be proportionate to labor. It is one thing to say that prices are determined by labor, and another thing to say that only labor should be paid for. Another problem with the labor theory of value is that some things which have never had any labor bestowed upon them still sell at a price. Even untouched virgin land can be bought and sold, and the value of the land will be much higher if it is found that some precious mineral lies under it. Collector's items like paintings by famous artists, rare stamps, or the finest wines may have a value which is far in excess of any labor expended on producing them. The classical economists and Marx were well aware of such examples, and they responded by dividing all goods into two categories: industrial products, goods that were indefinitely reproducible, like shoes, bread, or pencils, and goods that could not be reproduced, like rare antiques or mineral deposits. The labor theory of value applied only to industrial products, but this was assumed to be a category of great and growing importance. The classical economists also recognized that even shoes, bread, and pencils could fluctuate in price due to sudden changes in conditions. If the potato crop failed, the price of bread would sharply rise, as people substituted bread for the now unavailable potatoes. If the wheat crop failed, the price of bread would also rise, because of the reduced availability of a necessary ingredient of bread. The classical economists therefore used the labor theory of value to account for the stable long-run price, what Adam Smith called the natural price, and what modern economists call the equilibrium price. The theory was not used to account for all the numerous day-to-day fluctuations in price. Marx had great respect for two classical economists, Adam Smith and David Ricardo. Both Smith and Ricardo argue for a labor theory of value, though their theories are rather different from Marx's theory. Some scholars even deny that Smith or Ricardo had a labor theory of value at all. Smith, Ricardo, and Marx all recognize that there are many cases where natural long-run prices do not tend toward the corresponding quantities of labor. Smith and Ricardo respond to this fact by being prepared to drop the labor theory in any particular case where it seems to conflict with facts. Marx's approach is very different. Instead of equating value and price, Marx draws a sharp distinction between value and price. In Marx's theory, value is always completely determined by labor alone. Price is ultimately regulated by value, but not necessarily equal to value. Marx sees value as an abstract concept, like energy or mass in physics. Such concepts do not directly correspond with any observable fact, but they help to explain observed facts. It does not bother Marx that prices may depart from labor values, any more than it bothers a physicist that a feather will fall to the ground, while an airship, which is thousands of times more massive, will rise up from the ground. In Volume 1 of Capital, Marx begins by assuming that prices are equal to values, that things exchange precisely in the ratio of the number of hours of labor required to make them. But then Marx gradually introduces complicating factors. Only in Volume 3 does he attempt to move toward a realistic picture of capitalism, though he does insist that many of the conclusions of Volumes 1 and 2 still apply. Unfortunately, Marx completed and published only Volume 1 in his lifetime. The other three volumes were put together from his notes and published after his death. Volume 4 is a gigantic work in itself, the first ever full-scale history of economic thought. It is now usually published separately under the title Theories of Surplus Value. Marx's own argument for the labor theory of value is given near the beginning of Volume 1 of Capital.
Let us take two commodities, for example, corn and iron. The proportions in which they are exchangeable, whatever those proportions may be, can always be represented by an equation in which a given quantity of corn is equated to some quantity of iron. For example, 1/4 of corn equals X hundredweight of iron. What does this equation tell us? It tells us that in two different things, in 1/4 of corn and X hundredweight of iron, there exists in equal quantities something common to both. The two things must therefore be equal to a third, which in itself is neither the one nor the other. Each of them, so far as it is exchangeable, must therefore be reducible to this third. This common something cannot be a geometrical, a chemical, or any other natural property of commodities. Such properties claim our attention only insofar as they affect the utility of those commodities, make them use values. But the exchange of commodities is evidently an act characterized by a total abstraction from use value. If, then, we leave out of consideration the use value of commodities, they have only one common property left, that of being products of labor.
Marx therefore begins by assuming that prices are equivalent to values, defined as quantities of labor time. But he has to meet two obvious objections to this. What happens if the laborer is lazy or inefficient, or has to use inferior technology? It would then take him longer to make his product. Does this make his product more valuable? No, says Marx. Not any labor counts, but only what he calls socially necessary labor.
Some people might think that if the value of a commodity is determined by the quantity of labor spent on it, the more idle and unskillful the laborer, the more valuable would his commodity be, because more time would be required in its production. However, the total labor power of society counts as one homogeneous mass of human labor power, composed though it be of innumerable individual units. Each of these units is the same as any other, so far as it has the character of the average labor power of society, and takes effect as such. So far as it requires for producing a commodity no more time than is needed on average, no more than is socially necessary. The labor time socially necessary is that required to produce an article under the normal conditions of production with the average degree of skill and intensity prevalent at the time. The introduction of power looms into England probably reduced by one half the labor required to weave a given quantity of yarn into cloth. The hand loom weavers continued to require the same time as before, but for all that, the product of 1 hour of their labor represented, after the change, only half an hour's social labor, and consequently fell to one half its former value. What determines the value of any article is the amount of labor socially necessary. Each individual commodity is to be considered as an average sample of its class.
So Marx is saying that we take the total labor required to produce the whole supply of commodities of a particular kind and divide by the number of commodities. This gives the value of each and every commodity of that kind, regardless of the labor it happened to take to produce any one of those commodities.
The same amount of labor in favorable seasons is embodied in 8 bushels of corn, and in unfavorable seasons, only 4 bushels. The same labor extracts from rich mines more metal than from poor mines. Diamonds are of very rare occurrence on the Earth's surface, and hence their discovery costs, on the average, a great deal of labor time. With richer mines, the same quantity of labor would embody itself in more diamonds, and their value would fall. If we could succeed, at a small expenditure of labor, in converting carbon into diamonds, their value might fall below that of bricks.
But even if we consider only labor of average productivity and efficiency, socially necessary labor, as Marx calls it, some labor clearly produces more value than other labor. Marx's solution to this problem is simply to treat some kinds of labor as multiples of other kinds of labor. The least productive labor he calls simple average labor.
skilled labor counts only as multiplied simple labor, a given quantity of skilled labor being considered equal to a greater quantity of simple labor.
This is the end of part 2. Please download part 3 to continue.